So right now, inside your body, there is basically a bouncer deciding what lives and what dies.
Yeah, a bouncer making constant life or death calculation.
Right? And for decades, medicine has told you that this bouncer is like a ruthless, heavily armed soldier,
Yeah.
your immune system, just waging this bloody, never-ending war against the outside world.
The ultimate search and destroy mission, yeah.
Exactly. And the story goes that to stay healthy, that soldier just needs to identify the enemy and destroy it. But what if everything we know about that internal war is completely wrong?
It's a question that fundamentally changes how we view illness. Because if you view the body as a battlefield, then chronic disease looks like, well, a friendly fire incident.
Like a mistake.
Exactly, a tragic, stupid mistake by your own biology. But the reality we are uncovering is it's so much more sophisticated and, frankly, a lot more compassionate.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are taking on a massive paradigm shift in how we understand human health, disease, and honestly, the very concept of healing.
It is a huge shift.
It really is. Our source today is this groundbreaking 2026 academic paper by Dr. Bechara Sahili. It's titled Life Coherent Systems Immunology. And our mission today is to completely dismantle the way we typically think about the immune system.
We really need to unlearn a lot of old habits here.
We do. We are going to learn how to see the immune system, not from the perspective of a doctor looking at a lab chart, but from the organism's perspective, your perspective. We're moving away from this idea of a microscopic battlefield filled with collateral damage.
Right, and we're stepping into something that looks more like a vast, highly intelligent ecosystem. The author is asking us to make a profound visual and conceptual shift.
Yeah, going from that militaristic framework to an ecological one.
Exactly. It's a sensing network integrated with everything: your gut bacteria, your nervous system, your mechanical tissues, your stress levels, and yes, even your housing situation.
Which is wild, and we will definitely get into that.
We will. The paper contrasts observer-centered immunology, which is the traditional way we put patients into static diagnostic boxes, with organism-centered immune coherence.
Meaning, we are finally stepping back and asking, like, what is the living, breathing body actually trying to accomplish in its environment?
Precisely.
I want to dig right into that distinction because it hits on a frustration I think a lot of listeners have experienced. Think about how we usually interact with medicine. If you break your arm, the x-ray shows a jagged white line.
It's very obvious.
Right? The doctor points at it and says, there it is, broken, it's precise, it's clean. But if you are someone dealing with a chronic immune issue, maybe you have rheumatoid arthritis or, mysterious post-viral fatigue or chronic gut inflammation, you know that the x-ray machine is basically useless.
The diagnostic waters are incredibly murky.
They are. And yet, you still walk out of the rheumatologist's office with a label. You're told you have an autoimmune condition. Dr. Sahili calls this the trap of labels.
It is a profound trap, and the paper introduces a crucial concept here called observer humility. Now, the author is very careful to clarify something immediately. These diagnostic categories, lupus, asthma, psoriasis, fibrosis, they are absolutely vital tools.
Right, doctors need them.
A physician must be able to categorize the dominant biological pathway that's causing tissue damage. But, and this is the key, they are tools created by the observer. They are maps of the territory.
Maps, not the actual terrain.
Exactly. The danger arises when the medical system falls into what the paper calls possession by distinction.
Possession by distinction. That sounds like a cognitive bias.
That's exactly what it is. It happens the moment a useful category hardens into an assumed reality. The moment the doctor looks at the chart and the diagnosis essentially replaces the patient.
Wow. The label literally obscures the person.
Yeah, the pathway becomes the entirety of the disease. So a doctor might say, this is a type 2 inflammatory pathway, and they prescribe a drug to block that exact pathway. But in doing so, they forget that this pathway is operating inside a specific human being.
A human being with a whole life story.
Right, a unique developmental history, specific environmental exposures, and a current tissue state. The living history of the organism just disappears behind the label.
Okay, wait. I'm going to push back here. Because if I'm a patient listening to this and my kidneys are currently failing because of lupus, I want the map. I want the rigid label, and I want the drug that blocks the pathway.
Of course you do.
I mean, I don't really care about a philosophical debate regarding observer humility while my organs are shutting down. Don't we absolutely need these labels to save lives?
That is a completely valid reaction, and it's one the paper explicitly validates.
Yeah.
The organism-centered framework does not replace urgent, evidence-based pathway-blocking treatment.
Not good.
If your immune system is actively destroying your kidneys, you need aggressive immunosuppression immediately. The MAP is necessary to put out the fire. But here is the core issue with observer humility. The label only describes the specific way the house is burning right now.
It just describes where you've arrived.
Exactly. It tells us absolutely nothing about how you got locked in that state to begin with.
So it tells me I need the fire extinguisher, but it doesn't tell me who left the stove on. Or, like, why the smoke alarms are still ringing.
Precisely. Let's say we give you the lupus medication and it suppresses the inflammation. That is life-saving. But if we stop there, if we are possessed by the distinction that you simply have a genetic autoimmune defect, we miss the entire context.
We don't look any deeper.
Right. You don't ask why your body's regulatory margins collapse in the first place. We don't ask if there is uncleared cellular debris buried in the tissue or if there are persistent environmental toxins in your air.
Or what about sleep? Like profound sleep disruptions preventing your nervous system from resetting.
Absolutely. We treat the acute flare, but we leave you trapped in a biological holding pattern, just waiting for the drug to wear off so the fire can restart.
Because we're treating the label instead of the living process. That makes total sense. So if we look past the label and we accept that the immune system isn't just an army fighting a war, what is it actually doing?
This is where it gets really interesting.
Yeah, the paper introduces a redefinition that I found totally fascinating. It called immunity the organism's living boundary coherence process.
Boundary coherence, yes.
It's not about self versus non-self anymore. It's about staying closed enough to survive, but open enough to live.
This is perhaps the most fundamental shift in the entire paper. For almost a century, immunology was built on the self versus non-self paradigm. It was a very neat binary concept.
Very black and white.
Right. Your immune system recognizes what is you, your own cells, and it ignores them. It recognizes what is not you, bacteria, viruses, splinters, and it attacks them. But as biological science advanced, that model completely fell apart under the weight of reality.
Well, yeah, because if it just attacked anything that wasn't me, how would I eat?
Exactly.
Think about it. Every time you eat an apple or a piece of bread, you are introducing massive amounts of foreign, non-self proteins directly into your body.
Oh.
If the immune system were just a strict border patrol, eating would be a fatal event.
It would be a massive systemic inflammatory crisis 3 times a day.
Mm.
And the examples go far beyond eating. Consider the human microbiome.
Oh, right. All the bacteria in our gut.
You have trillions of commensal bacteria living in your gut, on your skin, in your respiratory tract. They are entirely non-self. Mm. Yet your immune system doesn't just ignore them. It actively cultivates them and communicates with them.
It works with them.
Yeah. Or look at pregnancy. A developing fetus is genetically half non-self. Under the old militaristic model, the maternal immune system should recognize the fetus as a massive parasite and destroy it.
That's terrifying to think about under that old model.
It is. But instead, the maternal immune system undergoes a radical systemic reorganization to actively tolerate, support, and vascularize the placenta.
So the body faces this incredible tension. A boundary can't just be a solid brick wall. If you build a solid wall around yourself, you starve to death. You die of isolation.
You have to interact with the world.
But it can't be completely open either, because then you just dissolve into the environment. You get consumed by pathogens.
Exactly. It's a dynamic negotiation. And this is where we have to rethink the concept of tolerance. We usually use the word tolerance to mean passively ignoring something. Like, you tolerate a loud neighbor by just putting on headphones and looking the other way.
Just enduring it.
Right. But in immunology, tolerance is an incredibly active, energy-intensive achievement. The immune system isn't just looking the other way when you eat a peanut or digest a harmless bacteria. It is actively generating signal.
It's doing work to tolerate it.
Yes. It deploys specialized cells, like regulatory T cells, which secrete specific anti-inflammatory molecules to quiet the surrounding tissue. It is constantly working, burning energy to say, do not attack this. This is safe.
Okay, wait. I'm trying to picture this. It sounds less like a strict border guard checking passports, and maybe more like, a bouncer at a really exclusive club who is also the event planner.
Oh, I like that.
Like, they have to know exactly which unruly patrons to throw out onto the street, but they also have to make sure the catering staff, the band, and the paying guests get inside, or else the party dies. And they are actively managing all of that at the front door.
That analogy works perfectly. And to extend it, what happens when someone develops a severe food allergy or inflammatory bowel disease?
The bouncer messes up.
Under the old model, we just said the bouncer became overactive and started attacking everyone. But under the boundary coherence model, we realize the organism has lost its boundary intelligence.
Wow.
It lost the capacity to safely evaluate what can be allowed in. The bouncer didn't just get aggressive. The bouncer lost the guest list and the ability to read the room. It lost the ability to negotiate that tension between protection and participation.
Which raises a huge question for me. If the immune system is this hyper-intelligent bouncer and event planner, constantly evaluating what to attack, what to tolerate, what to build, how is it making these decisions? There's no brain in the immune system.
Right. There's no central cortex weighing the pros and cons of a peanut protein.
So how does it think?
It doesn't have a centralized brain, but it absolutely processes information. And the paper uses a brilliant framework from cognitive science to explain this. It frames immunity as a form of biological cognition.
Biological cognition.
Specifically, it applies the 5E model of cognition. It argues that the immune system is embodied, embedded, enactive, extended, and evaluative.
Okay, that's a lot of E's.
It is. But basically, it makes sense of the world not through abstract thoughts, but through physical, biological states.
Okay, let's look at how these actually play out in the body, because it's completely changed how I experience being sick. Let's look at that first one. Embodied. The idea that immune responses are lived through body state changes.
Yes, the physical experience.
Think about the last time you had a terrible flu. You get a fever, your joints ache, you feel this crushing fatigue. I think all of us, and certainly most doctors, just view those as annoying side effects of the virus. Just collateral damage that we should suppress with Tylenol so we can get back to work.
It's the standard modern response. But from an organism-centered view, those states are not side effects. They are the cognition.
They are the cognition itself.
They are the physical manifestation of the body reorganizing itself to deal with the threat. Let's take the fever. A fever isn't just a broken thermostat. It is a highly coordinated systemic shift initiated by the immune system communicating with the hypothalamus in your brain.
It's doing it on purpose.
Actively. It raises your core temperature because higher temperatures speed up the metabolism and movement of your white blood cells, making them dramatically more efficient at hunting pathogens. Simultaneously, that heat makes the environment actively hostile to viral replication.
So the fever is the immune system literally changing the physics of the battlefield to gain an advantage. What about the fatigue? Because when I'm sick, I'm not just a little tired. I literally cannot get out of bed.
That fatigue is a profound, calculated reallocation of energy. Think about the sheer amount of ATP cellular energy required to mount a systemic immune defense. Millions of cells are dividing rapidly, producing massive quantities of inflammatory cytokines, generating oxidative bursts.
That sounds exhausting.
It is. Your body looks at your energy reserves and says, "We absolutely cannot afford to power your skeletal muscles for a morning jog right now. We are diverting all available power to the immune response."
So it forces you to stop.
Yeah, it alters your neurochemistry to induce behavioral withdrawal. Sickness behavior is an evolutionary adaptation. The fatigue forces you to lie down and conserve energy so the immune system can work. Even pain is an embodied cognitive signal. It forces you to immobilize a damaged tissue so it can repair without mechanical disruption.
The symptom is the strategy.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Okay, so if that's embodied, let's look at the second one, embedded. The idea that immunity is tissue specific. Does a signal actually mean something completely different depending on where it shows up?
Absolutely. Embedded means that the immune system does not operate in an abstract void. It is deeply embedded in local tissue ecologies.
Yeah.
Let's trace a specific molecular signal. Imagine a harmless piece of a bacterial cell wall.
Okay.
If your immune sensors detect that fragment in the lumen of your gut, the inner tube where food digests, it actively suppresses any inflammatory response. It recognizes the context. It says, "We are in the gut. There are trillions of bacteria here. This is normal background noise."
But what if that exact same fragment ends up somewhere else?
If that exact same molecular fragment crosses the gut barrier and enters the sterile environment of your bloodstream, or worse, if it enters the synovial fluid of your knee joint or the cerebrospinal fluid bathing your brain, the local immune sensors will trigger a massive screaming 5-alarm fire.
Wow, the molecule didn't change at all. Not one bit. The context changed. The tissue dictates the meaning of the signal. The immune system is embedded in local neighborhoods. It reads the mechanical stress of a tendon differently than the airflow of a lung or the fluid dynamics of a kidney.
And I imagine that explains why certain chronic diseases are so localized. Like, why does psoriasis only attack the skin while asthma only attacks the airways? If it was just a generalized autoimmune glitch, would the whole body be on fire?
Exactly. The tissue itself is actively participating in generating the disease. The structural cells of your skin, the keratinocytes, are communicating with the immune cells, creating a localized feedback loop. You can't understand the immune reaction without understanding the neighborhood.
Which brings up a really sticky problem. If the immune system is constantly reading the neighborhood, what happens when its own actions change the neighborhood? Because the paper calls this the third cognitive aspect, inactive. The idea that immune action changes the environment it just sensed.
It is a recursive loop,
right.
And it is crucial for understanding why chronic inflammation is so hard to stop. The immune system doesn't passively observe a pre-existing world. Its actions create the next version of the world it has to deal with.
Walk me through that.
Let's break down something simple, like getting a deep cut on your arm. The local tissue is breached, bacteria enter, the immune system senses danger and mounts an inactive response. It triggers acute inflammation. Neutrophils rush in and release toxic enzymes and reactive oxygen species to kill the bacteria.
But those toxic enzymes don't just magically target the bacteria, right? They're basically throwing grenades into the room.
Exactly. The oxidative stress kills the bacteria, but it also damages the surrounding innocent bystander cells. So now the local environment has changed. The immune system initially reacted to the cut in the bacteria, but now it has to sense and respond to the collateral damage it just caused.
It has to clean up its own mess.
Yes. It has to send in macrophages to clean up the dead neutrophils. Then it has to transition into a repair program, signaling fibroblasts to lay down collagen to close the wound.
And collagen is scar tissue. That changes the physical texture of the area.
Yes. The tissue is now mechanically stiffer. And the immune system sensors will read that new mechanical stiffness, which influences how it behaves next. It is a constant, ongoing conversation between the immune cells and the environment they are continuously remodeling.
I see where this gets dangerous. In a healthy cut, the loop eventually closes. But if it gets stuck, the inflammation causes collateral damage. The collateral damage triggers danger sensors. The danger sensors trigger more inflammation. The body ends up chasing its own tail.
It becomes a vicious cycle.
It's no longer responding to the original bacteria. It's responding to the wreckage of its own response.
That is the exact definition of a self-sustaining chronic inflammatory loop. It is responding to the world it built.
Okay, let's look at the fourth aspect of immune cognition. And I'll be honest, this is the one I struggle with the most. Extended.
This one throws a lot of people.
Yeah, the paper argues that immune regulation extends outside the physical body. It explicitly mentions housing, air quality, food systems, and public health. I have to push back here. Isn't this stretching the definition of biology too far? I mean, my apartment is not an organ. It feels like we are blurring hard science with sociology.
It absolutely sounds like a stretch until you look at the exact physiological mechanisms of how the outside world physically enters the cellular space. The paper argues that organisms exist in a state of structural coupling with their environment. Your immune system's daily calculations require material inputs from the outside.
Give me a specific mechanism. How does my ZIF code get into my cells?
Let's take a patient with severe asthma who lives in a damp, poorly ventilated apartment building situated right next to a heavily polluted highway. This is a common public health reality.
Sadly, yes.
First, the physical particulates. The diesel exhaust particles, the PM2.5, and the mold spores are literally, physically entering the airway with every breath. They land on the epithelial barrier of the lungs. The diesel particles induce severe oxidative stress on the lung cells, breaking down the tight junctions that keep the barrier intact.
So the physical wall is getting breached by the air itself.
Yes. The epithelial cells panic and release alarm signals, which skew the local immune cells, specifically T helper 2 cells, into a state of chronic hyperreactivity. The immune system is doing exactly what it should in a toxic environment. It is maintaining a defensive posture.
That makes biological sense.
But let's look at the second layer, the psychological stress of living in poverty or in unsafe housing. Chronic psychological stress causes the brain to continuously release cortisol.
And cortisol is supposed to be anti-inflammatory, right? That's why doctors give you cortisone shots for a swollen joint.
It is. But when cortisol is pumped into the bloodstream constantly, day after day, month after month, the immune cells do what they always do when overstimulated. They downregulate their receptors. They become resistant to cortisol.
Oh, wow.
They stop listening to the calm down signal. So now you have a patient whose lung barrier is structurally degraded by pollution and whose immune cells are literally deaf to the body's own anti-inflammatory hormones because of chronic social stress.
Wow. So treating that patient's lung with an inhaler while ignoring the fact that their housing is acting as a continuous pathogenic trigger, it's like bailing water out of a boat without plugging a hole.
It is biologically incoherent. The environment is not an abstract social concept. It is a material input. The immune system is extended because its ability to maintain coherence is completely dependent on the external resources it has access to.
That's a huge shift in perspective.
Clean air is an immune intervention. Safe housing is an immune intervention. A living wage is an immune intervention because it lowers the allostatic loop that degrades immune tolerance.
That completely shatters the idea that health is just a matter of personal, individual responsibility. We are literally porous to our world. And that brings us to the final aspect of cognition, evaluative. The system evaluates context to assign biological valence, basically deciding if something is good for me or bad for me.
Exactly.
So how do we organize all of this sensing, acting, and evaluating? The paper describes the immune system being pulled between three massive magnetic poles, or attractors: preservation, development, and coherence.
This is a beautifully elegant way to organize the sheer chaos of immunology. Think of these as the fundamental logic states of a living organism. First, you have the preservation attractor. This is the organism's absolute non-negotiable need to conserve its boundaries.
The defense mode.
Right. It encompasses defense against invasion, containment of damage, and the memory of previous threats. This is the classical defense mode. It is closed off, rigid, and highly reactive.
It's the bouncer kicking people out and locking the doors. But you can't live like that forever.
Exactly. Without preservation, you die quickly of acute infection. Or you succumb to cancer because the immune system fails to destroy malignant cells. But if you only have preservation, you are a fortress under siege. You will starve.
Which is where the second one comes in.
That's why you need the second attractor, development. Development is the organism's need to remain open to the world. It includes mucosal tolerance, symbiosis with the microbiome, tissue repair, growth, and cellular learning.
That's the bouncer opening the doors to let the catering staff in, or laying down new carpets after a fight in the club. So you have the push and the pull. Preservation pushes away, development takes in.
And the third attractor, coherence, is the flexible movement between the two.
I'm trying to picture how these interact in real time. It sounds like breathing. Like preservation is the exhale, you are pushing things out, clearing space, defending your boundaries. Development is the inhale, you are taking the world in, absorbing nutrients, growing.
That is a perfect way to look at it.
And coherence is the rhythm of the breath itself. If you get stuck exhaling, you suffocate. If you get stuck inhaling, you hyperventilate and burst. Health isn't just a matter of inhaling or exhaling. It's the seamless, context-appropriate transition between them.
That analogy captures the most vital element of this entire framework: time. Timing is everything in biology. A biological posture that is highly adaptive for a short period becomes profoundly destructive if it persists.
Right.
An inflammatory response, like the swelling and heat after you sprain an ankle, is perfectly coherent for 2 hours. It immobilizes the joint and brings in immune cells. But if that exact same inflammatory response lasts for 2 months, it becomes pathological. It destroys the cartilage.
Disease happens when the organism loses its rhythm.
Yes, when it gets structurally stuck in one of these attractors.
Let's explore what it looks like when we get stuck. If someone gets locked into that preservation attractor, what does that look like clinically?
If you get locked into preservation, the borders are permanently closed and the alarms are blaring 24/7. Clinically, this manifests as chronic inflammation, severe autoimmunity, hypervigilance, and severe allergies.
Everything is a threat.
The organism is evaluating everything: its own tissues, harmless pollen, normal food, as an existential threat. The bouncer is throwing everyone out, including the owner of the club.
And what if you get locked into the development attractor? Too much openness.
If you get locked into development, you lose boundary integrity entirely. The doors are propped open. This can look like profound vulnerability to opportunistic infections because the body refuses to mount a defense. Or, tragically, it looks like unchecked malignant growth.
Like cancer.
Yes. A tumor often tricks the immune system into a state of local tolerance. The immune system sees the cancer and says, oh, this is just new tissue developing, let it grow. But development isn't just about openness, it's also about repair.
Right, laying down collagen after an injury. How can you have too much repair?
When the repair program loses its exit signal, if a tissue is damaged, fibroblasts lay down collagen to scaffold the repair. But if the system is locked in the development attractor, it never stops. It keeps building and building scar tissue until the organ becomes stiff, heavy, and dysfunctional.
Oh, that's what fibrosis is.
Exactly. Pulmonary fibrosis in the lungs, cirrhosis in the liver. The tissue literally chokes on its own excessive repair mechanism.
So if health is this constant rhythmic breathing between preserving ourselves and developing ourselves, what actually gives the body the capacity to maintain that rhythm? Like if I'm deeply stressed or I haven't slept in a week, I feel like I lose my rhythm. Does the cellular immune system experience exhaustion?
It absolutely does. And this brings us to what I believe is the most critical takeaway for anyone dealing with a chronic illness.
Right.
Understanding the field of healing. The paper frames this as the tension between salutogenesis and allostatic load.
Let's break those down. Pathogenesis is the study of how we get sick. So salutogenesis is what? The study of how we generate health.
Exactly. Modern medicine is obsessed with pathogenesis. We spend billions mapping exactly how a virus breaks into a cell, but we spend a fraction of that studying how health is actively generated and maintained.
And we just assume health is the default.
Right. But health is not just a passive baseline state that you magically default to when the virus leaves. Health requires immense continuous work. The theory of salutogenesis argues that for an organism to remain coherent under stress, it needs specific resources. It needs the world to be comprehensible, manageable, and meaningful.
Okay, stop right there. Meaningful. I have to wave a massive red flag here. Are we saying that if a patient just finds meaning in their suffering or maintains a positive, upbeat attitude, their rheumatoid arthritis will magically go away?
Because
that sounds dangerously close to toxic positivity.
Yeah.
It sounds like we're telling patients, you're still sick because you just aren't thinking positively enough.
I am incredibly glad you flagged that because the paper goes out of its way to explicitly reject that interpretation. What you just described is toxic positivity, and it is a deeply harmful way to frame illness. The author draws a razor-sharp distinction between salutogenesis and salogenesis.
Salogenesis,
yeah.
Without the two in the middle.
Right. Salogenesis is the actual physical molecular act of healing. It is the biological work of clearing dead cellular debris, laying down new endothelial cells, shifting metabolic states from glycolysis back to oxidative phosphorylation.
Our biological labor.
That work requires raw materials and massive amounts of cellular energy. Salutogenesis, on the other hand, is the environment, the field, the resources that makes that biological work possible.
So finding meaning or feeling safe doesn't magically cure the damaged cells, but it changes the environment the cells are forced to operate in.
Exactly. Think of it like a bank account. Every time your immune system mounts an inflammatory defense, every time you lose a night of sleep, every time you endure chronic financial stress, it costs you biological currency. This is your allostatic load.
The physiological wear and tear.
The cumulative wear and tear of adapting to stress. If you continually spend that currency without recovering it, your allostatic load builds up to critical levels. You consume your body's regulatory margin.
You go into biological debt.
Severe biological debt. And when your allostatic load is too high, the organism literally cannot afford to complete a healing cycle, meaning manageability, safe housing, nutrient-dense food, deep restorative sleep, a supportive community. These are not magical cures. They are deposits into your biological bank account.
They fund the healing.
They lower the allostatic load. They provide the physiological safety and the energy margins required for the immune system to shift out of its hyper-defensive phase.
So if you're constantly in a state of threat, your autonomic nervous system is essentially screaming at your immune system, we are under attack, do not lower the shields, stay in preservation mode.
Exactly. If your nervous system perceives a lack of safety, whether from a predator or from systemic poverty or severe social isolation, it locks the immune system in a defensive posture. You cannot ask an exhausted, sleep-deprived, terrified body to perform the incredibly delicate, energy-intensive biological work of tissue remodeling.
It's like trying to do a luxury remodel of your kitchen while the house is actively being foreclosed on and the roof is caving in. You just don't have the resources or the safety to finish the project.
That's exactly it.
So Assuming we do have the resources, assuming we lower the allostatic load, how does the actual step-by-step process of healing work?
To map that out, we have to look at how the organism moves through time, transitioning between what the paper calls the health cycle and the healing cycle.
The health cycle is just normal everyday life.
Right. Yes. The health cycle is the ordinary rhythm of wake, eat, move, relate to others, clear waste, and sleep. In this state, your immune system is highly active, but it's doing quiet background surveillance. It's clearing away natural apoptotic dead cells, negotiating with your gut bacteria after lunch, keeping the engine humming without you ever noticing.
But then a perturbation hits. You get a viral infection or a severe physical trauma or a massive psychological stressor. We get knocked out of the health cycle.
And we enter the healing cycle. This model is heavily based on Dr. Robert Navio's concept of the cell danger response. When a severe threat hits, the organism drops its ordinary priorities. Energy is immediately diverted away from digestion, reproduction, and higher order cognitive tasks and routed directly into defense.
I want to walk through the exact steps of this healing cycle because I think a lot of us only know the first half.
Let's trace it. It starts with danger detection. The innate immune sensors recognize a breach. The body instantly moves into the next phase, defense and containment. This is the classic inflammatory response we all recognize. Swelling, fever, redness. The blood vessels dilate, and white blood cells like neutrophils rush into the tissue to kill the pathogen and wall off the damage.
Right, you get a cut, it gets red and angry, the bouncer is throwing punches, but then what? Because the redness doesn't just naturally fade away like a sunset.
This is a crucial point that modern medicine often overlooks. Inflammation does not just passively peter out when the bacteria are dead. The next mandatory step is resolution.
Resolution is an active step.
It is an active, heavily regulated biological process. It involves an entirely different set of molecules called specialized pro-resolving mediators, or SPMs. These molecules actively signal the neutrophils to stop releasing toxins. They tell the macrophages, which were previously in an aggressive killing state, to flip their programming into a repair state.
They tell the macrophages to put down their weapons and pick up the brooms.
Exactly, because the next and arguably most critical step is clearance. After a battle, the tissue is a graveyard. It is filled with dead neutrophils, bacterial fragments, ruptured cell membranes, and spilled mitochondria.
A debris field.
If that debris is not cleared out through a process called efferocytosis, where the macrophages literally swallow and digest the dead cells, the danger alarms will keep ringing. The surrounding tissue sensors will see the spilled mitochondrial DNA and think the tissue is heavily damaged. The threat must still be here.
Oh, wow. So your immune system could successfully kill the virus on day three. But if the garbage trucks never come to haul away the debris, the tissue stays inflamed for months because it keeps tripping over the cellular trash, thinking there's still a war going on.
Precisely. Resolution without clearance is a biological trap. Once the debris is successfully cleared and drained through the lymphatic system, the organism can move to repair and remodeling, where fibroblasts rebuild the scaffolding. Then comes memory, where the adaptive immune system updates its files, creating antibodies, so it's prepared for the next encounter. And finally, the step that almost everyone forgets.
Re-entry. This is the one that really hit me hard. Think about a patient who goes to their doctor after a severe infection. The virus is gone. Their inflammatory markers in the blood are totally normal. The doctor looks at the chart, smiles, and says, "Great news, you're perfectly healthy. The infection is cured."
We see this constantly.
But the patient is sitting there thinking, "I can't walk up a flight of stairs. I have brain fog so thick I can't read an email. I can't play with my kids." Healing is not complete until re-entry happens.
This is the tragedy of how we define recovery. Normal lab results are not the finish line. The finish line is re-entry into the health cycle. Can the organism return to ordinary rhythms of restorative sleep, physical movement, nutrient absorption, and social participation without triggering a massive symptom crash?
Right.
If a patient is trapped in post-viral fatigue, their healing cycle is unfinished. Modern medicine is exceptionally brilliant at managing the defense phase. We have powerful antibiotics to kill bugs and heavy-duty immunosuppressants to crush inflammation, but we often completely ignore the biological requirements for clearance, repair, and reentry.
We act like firemen who show up, spray the house with water to put out the fire, and then just drive away. And then we look at the patient living in the wet, burnt-out shell of a house and say, "Why are you complaining? The fire is out. You should be hosting dinner parties." It's incredibly invalidating. Which brings us to the absolute core thesis of this paper. What happens when the cycle stops spinning?
This is the master concept that ties everything together. Health is defined as adaptive phase shifting. Chronic immune disease is defined as maladaptive phase locking.
Phase shifting versus phase locking. Let's dig into that.
In a state of health, you shift through the phases seamlessly. You detect danger, you defend, you resolve, you clear the debris, you repair the tissue, you update memory, and you re-enter life. It's a fluid progression. But in chronic immune disease, the organism becomes maladaptively locked in one of those specific phases. A biological posture that was designed to be temporary becomes a permanent structural trap.
I keep trying to picture this. It sounds like, I don't know, a giant orchestra playing a symphony. But midway through the song, the brass section just gets stuck on one blaring dissonant chord. They refuse to move to the next measure. The brass players aren't inherently evil. They just won't stop playing that one note, and it ruins the entire song. The music breaks down.
That is a brilliant analogy, and the paper meticulously breaks down the specific ways the orchestra gets stuck. Let's examine the defense lock. This is classical autoimmunity or chronic inflammation. The original danger, maybe a virus or an environmental toxin, might be long gone, but the body is locked in an aggressive defense posture. It won't stop attacking its own joints or its own thyroid.
And what about the clearance lock?
This is exactly the garbage truck problem we just discussed. The immune complexes, the dead cells, the metabolic toxins build up, the lymphatic drainage pathways are overwhelmed or stagnant. The local alarms keep ringing because the debris field is still there.
And the repair lock.
That's fibrosis. The fibroblasts start rebuilding the damaged tissue, which is exactly what they're supposed to do, but they never receive the chemical signal to stop. They just keep laying down thick collagen fibers, overbuilding the tissue until the organ, like a lung or a liver, becomes incredibly stiff and fails. The repair mechanism itself becomes the fatal disease.
And then, of course, the reentry lock.
Yes. The acute infection, like a mild case of COVID-19 or an Epstein-Barr virus infection, is resolved. The overt inflammation might be gone, but the patient is trapped in a profound energy conservation mode. Their autonomic nervous system is severely dysregulated. They experience post-exertional malaise. This is what we see in long COVID or myalgic encephalomyelitis, also known as MECFS.
They're just stuck at the threshold.
Exactly. The patient is standing right outside the doors of the health cycle, but their biology simply cannot generate the energetic output required to re-enter.
So if I'm a doctor, my job has to completely change based on this framework. The clinical task is no longer just, oh, you have inflammation, let me write a prescription to suppress your immune system. It requires a totally different diagnostic approach. The paper calls it phase state reasoning.
Exactly. The physician must step back and ask a radically different set of questions. Not just what diagnostic box can I put this symptom in, but what specific biological phase is this patient locked in right now? And crucially, what resources do they need to complete that phase and move to the next one?
Because the treatment has to match the lock.
Precisely. If a patient is in a defense lock, actively destroying your kidney, yes, they might need an immunosuppressant to halt the tissue destruction. But if a patient is in a clearance lock, aggressively suppressing their immune system might actually make them worse because you are paralyzing the very macrophages, the garbage trucks, that they need to clear the debris.
That makes so much sense.
They might need lymphatic drainage support, sleep optimization, or agents that actively promote efferocytosis. If they are in a repair lock, they need targeted antifibrotic therapy to break down the scar tissue. If they are in a reentry lock, pushing them to exercise their way out of it will cause a massive metabolic crash. They need extreme pacing, autonomic nervous system stabilization, and mitochondrial support.
It's so elegant. You have to zoom out to see the whole cycle to know what the body is trying to finish. But to truly appreciate how a lock happens in the first place, the paper forces us to zoom all the way down to the microscopic molecular level. How do cells know when to sound the alarm at all? How does the cell actually decide if it's in danger?
This is where we look at the molecular architecture of the immune system. The paper discusses complex intracellular sensors, things like pattern recognition receptors, inflammasomes, and the CGS sting pathway. These are the microscopic tripwires inside and outside your cells that detect trouble. But the critical paradigm-shifting insight here is that these receptors don't just react blindly to the presence of a foreign object, they evaluate context.
Right. This goes back to the idea that the immune system evaluates the neighborhood. The paper uses a very specific term for this, adjuvanticity. What exactly does that mean?
Adjuvanticity essentially means the context of danger surrounding a specific molecule. Let's take a deep dive into one specific pathway the paper highlights. CGS sting. This pathway detects double-stranded DNA. Now, DNA is the blueprint of life. It is packed inside the nucleus of almost every single cell in your body. If your intracellular immune sensors detect double-stranded DNA safely wrapped up inside the nucleus, they completely ignore it. It belongs there. It is safe.
But what happens if the cell gets damaged?
If a cell is crushed by trauma, or if a mitochondrion, which has its own DNA, ruptures due to severe oxidative stress, or if a virus invades and starts replicating its viral DNA, that double-stranded DNA might end up floating freely in the cytosol. The cytosol is the jelly-like fluid inside the cell, outside the nucleus.
If it's in the wrong compartment.
Exactly. And the CGS sting sensor is sitting in the cytosol. When it binds to DNA floating in that space, it triggers a massive explosive inflammatory alarm cascade. The molecule itself did not change. The DNA is exactly the same DNA, but the context changed.
The location.
Yes, the spatial location changed. The immune system evaluated the context and said, DNA in the nucleus is health. DNA in the cytosol means we are under severe attack or structural collapse.
And the same logic applies to things outside the body, right? Like food.
Absolutely. Think about digesting a peanut protein. If you digest that peanut in a healthy, intact gut, with a robust mucosal barrier and plenty of happy regulatory T cells secreting calming signals, the immune system reads the context and tolerates the peanut. But if you encounter that exact same peanut protein in a gut that is highly inflamed from a recent viral infection, where the barrier is leaky and the local tissues are screaming with danger signals, the immune system links the harmless peanut protein to the surrounding danger context.
It associates it with the fire.
Exactly. It learns to associate the peanut with the fire, and suddenly you have a severe food allergy.
I think I have an analogy for this. It's not about just recognizing a spark. Think about a spark. A spark inside a stone fireplace on a freezing winter night is totally fine. It's cozy. It's tolerated. But a spark flying through the air inside a fireworks factory is a massive, immediate catastrophe. It signifies extreme, explosive danger. The immune system's molecular sensors aren't just looking at the spark. They are intensely evaluating whether they are standing in a fireplace or a fireworks factory.
That is the perfect way to visualize adjuvanticity. The immune system is constantly evaluating the entire field of context. And this is exactly why you cannot understand chronic systemic disease by just pulling a vial of blood and looking at one single biomarker or one isolated autoantibody.
The autoantibody is just the spark.
Yes, an autoantibody is just a spark. You have to look at the whole tissue niche. You have to look at the organism's entire history of exposures, their microbial ecology, their sleep debt, their allostatic load. You have to ask, is this patient's body a fireplace right now, or is their entire biology a highly volatile fireworks factory?
And if they are a fireworks factory, giving them a single drug that just tries to blow out one specific spark isn't going to fix the underlying volatility. We have to change the context. We have to rebuild the fireplace. We have to give them the resources to move out of danger detection, clear the debris, and get back into life. Man, this is it's a completely transformative way of seeing ourselves. Let's start pulling the lens back from the molecular level, back to the macro, human level. As we wrap up this deep dive, let's recap the journey we've taken today. We started by dismantling this old, rigid, aggressive idea of the immune system as an internal military force, fighting a black and white war against non-self. Instead, Dr. Salaili's paper has shown us that immunity is this brilliant evaluative boundary coherence process. It's a cognitive system that senses, acts, and gets shaped by everything from our gut bacteria to the air quality in our neighborhoods.
And crucially, we learn that chronic illness is rarely just the body attacking itself out of nowhere or making a stupid biological error. Often, it's a profound, vital healing cycle that started with a totally valid perturbation, a virus, a toxin, a massive stressor, but became unfinished. It is a phase lock. The organism got trapped in a necessary defense, or simply lacked the energetic resources to clear the debris, or it couldn't stop repairing, or it just ran out of the biological margins needed to re-enter ordinary life.
So if you are listening to this right now and you are navigating the murky waters of a chronic immune condition, or you are caring for someone who is, I think the most beautiful, validating takeaway from this entire framework is that it completely removes the blame. Your body is not broken. It is not stupid. It is not rebelling against you. It is doing its absolute best to conserve your life under immense complex constraints. It might just be lacking the energetic margins, the salutogenic resources, or the specific biological transition signals it needs to finish the difficult work it started. It is simply waiting for the right conditions to move forward.
That deep empathy is the beating heart of this paper. I want to leave everyone with a final staggering concept drawn from the very end of Dr. Salaili's framework. We've talked extensively about how immune coherence requires external resources. Safe housing, clean air, restorative sleep, nutritious food, and social safety. These are the absolute biological prerequisites for lowering allostatic load and completing a healing cycle. So what does it mean when we live in a society that chronically, systematically deprives millions of people of those exact things? What happens when our modern world normalizes profound sleep deprivation, ultra-processed food, chronic economic precarity, and polluted environments? The paper asks a chilling question. Are we medicalizing individual bodies for phase locking when our modern civilization itself is acting as a giant, continuous, anti-salutogenic perturbation? If the world keeps triggering the cellular danger response, we shouldn't be surprised when our bodies refuse to turn the alarms off. It's something to deeply consider the next time you look at the rising global rates of chronic disease.
That is a staggering thought to end on. We're frantically treating the broken X-ray while completely ignoring the fact that the X-ray machine is sitting inside a burning building. Thank you for taking this deep dive with us today. Keep asking hard questions, keep looking at the wider context of your environment, and try looking at your own biology through this incredibly validating, life-coherent lens. We'll catch you on the next one.